You are listening to From the Margins on CHSR 97.9 in Fullerton.
Aggressive state intervention into the local labor movement that ensures that the radical labor movements are marginal.
What they're looking for now is less to get elected and more to come to the favorable attention of capital.
For the first time in history, we have a movement in this country led by indigenous peoples and most importantly, indigenous women.
Repeatedly, we've seen the attempt to criminalize black victims, to do anything to smear their names, to basically imply that black life isn't worth anything.
Our society teaches women to be ashamed of their bodies, to hate their bodies, to change their bodies.
We see increasing organized repression.
I'm stubborn. I'm not going to back down. This could go on for years and years and years.
People need to realize what type of struggle that they're on.
The police, of course, want you to believe that there's some kind of criminal reason behind this.
Take every day as an act of resistance, whether it was a strike, a riot, or whatever.
It's very difficult for people to engage in sustained dissent. I don't believe it's impossible, though.
And good afternoon. This is From the Margins for this November 13. And lots has happened in this past week. And on the show today, talking about two subjects that were very important in this past week, and talking to the same person to deal with both, UNB history professor Jeff Brown, on an essay that him and another professor at UNB, political science professor Tom Workman, wrote called Lest We Remember, which problematizes the idea of the Remembrance Day celebration and whether or not it is an actual recognition of the horrors of war in the past or perhaps a validation of current and future wars. And the second subject, of course, the other big thing that happened this past week that the whole world is talking about is the U.S. election. So also talked to Jeff Brown about this subject as well, sort of a U.S. election post-mortem. Now, some details on Professor Jeff Brown. He is a professor of history at the University of New Brunswick with a focus on American history. He was born and raised in the United States and spent much of his youth as an anti-war activist. As a professor, he has taught courses on American radicalism, American modernism, African-American history, and the United States during the 60s, amongst other subjects. So without further ado, here is piece number one. This is Jeff Brown reading the essay that him and Tom Workman wrote called Lest We Remember. All right. So now, Jeff, there's a couple of things that we wanted to talk about today. One was this piece that you and Professor Tom Workman wrote.
Lest We Remember. Tom and I, over the years, have talked about our common aversion to Remembrance Day, and in fact, have discussed the fact that we both kind of dread it. Neither one of us have ever worn the poppy, but we're surrounded by people who do, and it's always a little depressing. And that's what spurred us to write this piece, is we wanted to explain where we were coming from on this, what our thinking was.
All right. So without further ado, Jeff, did you want to tell us what you said?
Remembrance Day, November 11th, is upon us once again. The red poppy has burst forth and is now blooming on every lapel. And on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, we will commemorate our war dead. Across Canada, there's been a push to raise the profile of November 11th. Bill C-597, for example, aims to compel Ontario, Quebec, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia to make Remembrance Day a paid statutory holiday, as it is in the rest of the country. It is paramount, declared a Canadian Legion official commenting on the bill, that the significance of Remembrance Day is inculcated into our youth and to the general population to show their respect for the sacrifices of our fallen. The Legion's Guide for Teachers stresses that Canadians have a duty to remember our war dead and their sacrifices for our freedoms. In these sentiments, the familiar narrative of war and memorialization is rehearsed. The world is a dangerous place, and many in it do not share our values. Wars are terrible, but they are sometimes necessary to preserve our fundamental institutions of freedom and democracy. Those who have fallen and service to this noble cause must never be forgotten, not only because of their heroic sacrifice, but also because, and this is another quote from the Legion Guide, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The link between past warfare and peaceful future is forged every November 11th. Honoring those who died on the battlefield, it is assumed, will somehow help the nation choose peace over war. Every November 11th, though, the reality of warfare is largely forgotten. It's actually suppressed. Remembrance Day is a misnomer. It neither preserves the memory of war nor promotes peace. It does the opposite of this. It obfuscates the reality of war in order to make future wars easier to embrace. A Remembrance Day that truly recalled the obscenity of war would leave us viscerally repelled. We would have to confront the waste, brutality, and evil of war, the utter perversion of everything good and decent in human beings. Our war dead would not be glorified for their selfless service in a noble cause. We would mourn them rather as sacrificial victims of states and empires, of politicians and generals, of bankers and industrialists, for whom war is always axiomatically about wealth and power. Through its arresting shibboleths about war heroes and sacrificial mothers, its solemn pageantry, and the increasingly harsh censure of dissenters, Remembrance Day amounts to a celebration of slaughter rather than a condemnation of war. A Remembrance Day that genuinely promoted peace would expose the lies of the war makers and demystify the mechanisms by which they were spread and made persuasive. It would systematically refute all the mendacious old myths about duty to the nation state, about the glory of killing and dying for it, about the masculine testing ground of the battlefield, about the ideal of physical courage in combat that have so often served as tools of recruitment and indoctrination. If Remembrance Day honored anyone, it would honor the true heroes of war, those who had the moral courage to refuse and resist, braving the opprobrium of the patriots and the persecution of the state in order to stand against the enormous power of what one dissident of the First World War, Randolph Bourne, called the war suction. It makes sense that it is the war that killed millions a century ago, reputed at the time to be the one that would end all wars, that supplies the symbols, the poppies, the cenotaphs, the elevens, for a day dedicated to willful blindness to the truth of war. One can understand the imperative to encourage people to forget a capitalist slaughter perpetrated by a wealthy elite and their generals in a struggle to carve up and appropriate the world's resources. One can understand the need to confer some meaning, some purpose, some redeeming quality on 4 years of insensate violence that produced nothing but blood money for profiteers and arms makers. The fact that the elites made a killing through killing, as they always do, is nowhere in evidence on Remembrance Day, nor is it acknowledged on November 11th that raising armies and forcing them to fight required state coercion, propaganda, conscription, and brute force on a massive scale, or that this coercion eventually manifested itself in summary mass executions as desertion, insubordination, and mutiny at the front threatened to force a premature peace. And we hear nothing of Russia at the cenotaph, where the carnage and its handmaidens, famine and disease, fueled a socialist revolution that the Western powers, including Canada, sought to overturn by armed intervention in 1918 and after. Indeed, prosecuting the war provided the pretext for silencing socialists and other dissenters in all the belligerent countries, a project carried out by censorship, incarceration, deportation, and murder. Donald Trump's vow to see Hillary Clinton thrown in jail is not without precedent. In 1918, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson enjoyed the spectacle of his erstwhile election rival, Socialist Party leader Eugene Debs, convicted to 10 years in prison for speaking out against the war. Of course, Trump's outrage at Clinton's email infractions are as ironic as they are disingenuous. For in a just society, a society that actually remembered, Hillary Clinton would be vilified not for email carelessness, but for her war crimes as Secretary of State. The truth of war cannot be heard above the 21-gun salutes and fighter jet flyovers of Remembrance Day. Dying bodies scream as they bleed, vomit, defecate, and writhe in pain. Mothers wail as children burn. Fathers sob as they frantically dig through rubble, hoping to find a son or daughter who has not been crushed. Children cry for parents who will never come home. We will not think of refugees fleeing for their safety, dropping dead from hunger and thirst, or more recently, drowning along the way. We will not remember the Afghan and Iraqi children killed by dysentery caused by contaminated drinking water, or those who must live amidst the depleted uranium and unexploded cluster bomblets left by invading coalitions of the willing. We will not remember the countless girls forced into sexual slavery by rampaging armies, or that the rape of women is a common military tactic, and that sexual violence is widespread in all war zones, or that militaries deliberately target civilian infrastructures and attack civilian populations, or that ethnic cleansing is a routine feature of war. We certainly won't recall the violent ethnic cleansing of the Indigenous peoples of Canada, or the ethnic cleansing and imprisonment of Japanese-Canadian civilians during the so-called Good War. Indeed, we will not bother to observe that the word civilian masks the fact that it is women who often bear the brunt of managing the horrors of war, everything from protecting children to caring for the broken veterans who survive. Nor will we recall the epidemic of PTSD, addiction, and suicide that currently plagues the soldiers and veterans of North America. We will forget that the children of Pakistan and Yemen today fear the clear blue sky because it heightens the danger of drone strikes. And we will forget especially the contemporary folly of far-flung aggression by the United States and its allies, including Canada, attacks and invasions that have often removed democratically elected governments and consigned countries, now called failed states by the imperialist club, to decades of misery. Nor will we recall that Canada was part of a warring coalition that installed a government in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, which now has a much worse human rights record than the vanquished Taliban, whether Canada's participation in the Afghan invasion was driven by the interests of its mining corporations, among the largest in the world, which were determined to get in on the resource bonanza of the conquest. War is scrubbed clean on Remembrance Day and unfolds in pristine parks to invoke the pristine image of war. Neatly pressed suits and crisp uniforms and brass obligatos correspond to the nation's neatly pressed and shiny false memory. Long moments of silence echo the calculated silence, the ritualized and increasingly aggressive silencing of the authentic recollection of war. We note that some Canadians now talk of poppy Nazism. Remembrance Day suppresses the memory of war while propagating the old lies and myths that help perpetuate it. The red poppy, as with many political symbols of humanity's war-torn past, helps keep the war masters pumped and the war machine primed. Like the poppies of Oz, its fumes incite an amnesiac slumber.
And that was, just a second here, that's better, sound coming from my computer. Jeff Brown, professor of history at UNB, reading the essay that he co-authored with political science professor at UNB, Tom Workman, Lest We Remember. And people who are curious to see that whole essay and wish to check it out, it's on the New Brunswick Media Co-op website. If you go to nbmediacoop.org, you will find it there pretty easily. If you can't, just search in the search box and it will appear in no time. Okay, so going to go quickly to a song break here to, I guess, reflect in some sense on the content that was just played. Not really reflect because the song preceded the content, but here's Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore, and then we'll continue with the U.S. election postmortem. ¶¶
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look how we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.
That was Phil Oakes with I Ain't Marching Anymore. So next up on the show, U.S. election post-mortem. So this is continuing the conversation with Jeff Brown and getting into a number of questions that people have. Now, if anybody's been paying attention to the media, in the last several days, there's been a number of protests against the Trump presidency. He's president-elect. He will take office at some point, but there are many who are opposing this prospect. Thousands of people, 8,000 marching against Trump in Los Angeles, recent post, and again, it's been going on for pretty well since the election. So this is a very contentious and ongoing topic about the Trump presidency. But what we talked about in this conversation was a number of subjects, including was Trump in fact the more dangerous person, or was it Clinton? What would have happened if Bernie Sanders won the Democratic nomination instead of Hillary Clinton? What does the Trump election say about the sentiments of the U.S. electorate? What were they thinking? Well, is it that the U.S. electorate are simply racist, or is there a better explanation than that? Okay, without further ado, here is that conversation continued with Jeff Brown on the U.S. election. So, Jeff, thank you for recounting that piece that you just produced with Professor Tom Workman. Now, I want to segue to the event that has just happened in the U.S. that everyone's talking about, the United States election. And I just have this point to give you, and I want to see what you think. So over the course of the U.S. election night, the website for Immigration Canada actually crashed as many fearful Americans worried about a Trump presidency were looking for ways to escape the so-called impending doom. According to these and many others, the worst-case scenario played out. The most dangerous candidate out there, who will deport all Muslims, build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, further oppress women in the U.S., deny climate change, and escalate its progression, and who is more likely to wage war on countries around the world, the so-called finger on the nuclear button, that this is the guy that won and beat out the safer option of Clinton. who, with all her faults, would at least keep the U.S. together and not destroy the planet. So this is a narrative that I've heard from a lot of people that was recounted over and over again in the lead-up to the election. What are your thoughts on this idea of Clinton was safer than Trump?
Well, there's a lot there to chew on. I think it's a toss-up myself. Trump is a bombastic buffoon. He's a misogynist. He's a racist. He's a plutocrat. I don't think anybody, or I certainly didn't want him to be president. I would never have voted for him. But neither would I have ever voted for Hillary Clinton, because she scares me almost as much, or maybe just as much. I think one thing that Trump doesn't have is a record. Clinton's record is all too clear. She's a neoliberal imperialist warmonger. Her fingerprints are all over the disaster of Libya. She supported the coup in Honduras. She supported a fascist coup in the Ukraine. Her modus operandi seems to be to put Russia on the defensive. She supported the invasion of Iraq. She is in full support of U.S. intervention in Syria and would like to impose a no-fly zone there. In fact, she's promised that that would be one of the first things she would do if she became president. That would put us on a collision course with Russia. None of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy adventures as Secretary of State and none of what she promises to do or promised to do as president are dictated by concerns about democracy or human rights or making the world a better place for the majority of people. They're concerned by geostrategic and neoliberal imperatives. They're motivated by a ruling class desire to aggrandize its wealth and power over and against others. It's about positioning the United States advantageously in the Middle East. It's about opening a corridor between Saudi Arabia and Europe for an oil pipeline. It's about ensuring that the United States maintains control of the price of oil and access to oil in the Middle East, and ensuring essentially that U.S. global hegemony is maintained by any means necessary. In contrast, Trump has said some things that fly in the face of that project. Trump has questioned the need for that kind of projection of global forces. Trump has talked about sitting down with Putin and finding ways to work on the world's problems together. I'm not sure how sincere Trump is. A lot of what he says is contradictory. He's also said about making the American armed forces great again, as if they aren't already the most powerful military machine ever seen on this planet. It's hard to know where Trump is going to go, but in terms of foreign policy, at least, I think Clinton's record and her promises made her the more dangerous of the two.
Just one more point on the little statement I made. There was a crashing of the Immigration Canada website on the night of the election because of a concern a lot of people in the U.S. Had over the future under Trump. Now, Jeff, you can recount in your own history of coming from the United States to Canada, perhaps a sentiment that was in some ways similar to concern over political climate, which led you here. Do you want to just recount some of that?
Oh, sure. I was born in Western New York in Rochester. All of my adult life, I've been an anti-war activist and, I don't know, I suppose a radical. I'm not quite sure. A left-wing radical of various sorts. I was finishing my PhD in 2001 when 9/11 happened. I experienced the chill of that climate after 9/11. George Bush was president. There was a great deal of anti-war activity, but it was tremendously unpopular. People speaking out against the wars being fomented by Bush at the time were vilified. My tires were slashed at one point for having anti-war stickers on my car. There was a real patriotic, xenophobic, Islamophobic frenzy in the air. I was tremendously uncomfortable with it. I was very lucky. I finished my PhD. I had previously married a Canadian, So I knew it was possible for me to work in Canada, and there was a job opening in Canada right here at UNB, and I managed to get that job, and I came here in 2002. So I can't quite call myself a political refugee, but the circumstances definitely made the move to Canada more attractive. And I was very happy to leave the U.S., and I'm extremely happy that I'm not there now. That said, if Trump turns out to be as bad as people fear that he will, we don't need tons of Americans coming to Canada. We need tons of Americans hitting the streets in the United States. We need people speaking out, writing, and organizing. I hope that Americans will consider that before they come. You know, people are worried about this potential fascism, and they make lots of, in my view, misinformed comparisons between, say, the United States circa 1916 and Germany circa 1933. History never repeats itself, never has, never will, and the circumstances are much different. I don't see Donald Trump as, you know, Hitler reincarnated. I think he's alarming in many ways, but I think he's somebody that we need to resist. And we need to channel that populist energy that went into his campaign in a more productive direction.
We'll get back to that.
Yeah,
well, I guess I was going to... Oh, my voice is real deep today. I'll transition into that. So a lot of the news, a lot of the coverage and the backlash is that it's, you know, dumb, racist, sexist, and America's full of them, and that's why Trump won. That it's an issue of, you know, the dumb rednecks. We didn't know we had that many in our country. Somehow they've taken over the country, and they all elected Donald Trump into power. And kind of talking about, I guess my question to you is, can we problematize that view, that kind of guttural reaction to Trump winning? And how problematic is it to kind of critique this election as election solely premised around that kind of facet?
Yeah, I think that view is really superficial. It's understandable. It's a knee-jerk kind of response to this. And of course, it fits right in with the Clinton campaign because, I mean, Trump said all kinds of stupid, contradictory, sexist, racist things. But he was also saying other things. What was picked up on by the mainstream media were the stupid, sexist, racist, misogynist things that he said. Those were the things that were amplified. Nobody paid much attention to the other things that he said, except people who were inclined to listen. There was an op-ed in the Globe and Mail today that the basic message was, if you thought it wasn't about race, well, now you know it really was. It was all about race. Well, it wasn't about race. That's not to say that there aren't Trumpists, that there aren't full-blown supporters of Trump who are racist, sexist, xenophobes, anti-immigrant, what have you. There are people like that in the United States. There's a solid minority like that in the United States, and there's a bunch of people, many. Most of those people were attracted to Trump. I think, though, that what swung the election for Trump was not that. It was the fact that he was analyzing and promising a remedy for sustained and endemic class divisions in the United States. That election was about class politics far more than it was about identity politics. The Democrats and Clinton have been able to appropriate identity politics for themselves. And I think one of the problems with American political culture now is that class politics had almost disappeared. Identity politics had become, in many cases, the only game in town. Well, identity politics, the demand for inclusion, the demand for tolerance, the quest for equality, all of that stuff, I think, is totally legitimate. But all of that stuff is easily accommodated in the existing system. And neoliberal capitalism isn't threatened by bathrooms that are open to transsexuals. And Hillary Clinton can quite easily enact policies, talk in ways that are very palatable to folks who feel themselves to be sexual or gender or racial minorities. Class politics is a little trickier. And I think that that's where Trump's power really, really came from. You know, the people who voted for Trump were people who wanted an end to the status quo. They wanted an end to Clintonian neoliberalism. They wanted an end to the establishment politics of both the Republican and the Democratic Party. Their jobs have disappeared. The manufacturing base in the United States is gone. Now, it makes sense that in the absence of the kind of healthy institutions that might channel working class dissent, it makes sense, and historically it's always been the case, that the working class is vulnerable to right-wing demagogues. And I think that's what happened here. I don't think that the majority of Americans are racist, sexist, xenophobic knuckle draggers. I think, though, that the majority of Americans are deeply discontented with the establishment politics of the last 30, 40 years.
And kind of playing up on that, there's always talk, like the breakdown is always around demographics. It's always 54% of white males over the age of 44 voted for Trump, or the black community, people under the ages of 25 or whatever, voted for Clinton. I guess kind of looking at why is there a continued in the American political scene this look on demographics, but never like I never see anything like people under a certain income. Is there a problem to viewing politics in this kind of demographic breakdown versus other ways of examining kind of political participation?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good point. Before I really tackle that question, though, I just want to say that even in terms of the demographic metrics that are out there now, the notion that Trump's victory was about race is called into question. For instance, I think there are seven states, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania. I don't know how many I got there. Mm-hmm. But these are states that went for Obama in 2008 and 2012. They all went for Trump this time around. How do we explain Obama's victory in those states if they're racist? I've got a problem with that. But in terms of demographics in general, I think that's part of a much larger trend in the U.S., and it's a historical trend. It's been going on for a long time, and I think it's about the marginalization of class as a category for explaining anything in American society. Class and class analysis is more or less taboo. It's not a permissible mainstream conversation, and this goes back to the Red Scare. It goes back to the reaction against the Popular Front in the 1940s and 50s. And I don't think that analysis has ever really recovered. And of course, the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party have been instrumental in either crushing or appropriating the union movement, which is far smaller than it was, say, in the 1930s. So there are not a lot of institutional venues in which class is analyzed, in which it's discussed. I think demographics, in a way, those sorts of demographics that you're talking about, it sort of filled the vacuum. And there's a very loud, glaring absence, which is class. And people still aren't talking in terms of class in the mainstream media in response to this election.
So some statistics based on voting behavior and people's sentiments after voting. 72% of Americans who voted believe that, quote, the economy is rigged to the advantage of the rich and powerful. And, quote, traditional parties and politicians don't care about people like me. And 68% of people who voted felt that way. So this disillusionment with the mainstream, essentially. In saying that, I want to come back to something that's also been a heavy conversation topic, is the idea of the so-called anti-establishment vote and how Trump represented someone that these people who were feeling disillusioned by mainstream politics felt like Trump was saying something different. But there's another person who was saying something different a while ago as well. His name is Bernie Sanders, who is also a candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party, and was considered by many to be the left anti-establishment choice versus Trump as the right anti-establishment choice. So what are your thoughts on this kind of sentiment made by a lot of people about how mainstream politics wasn't working for them and this idea of the anti-establishment vote?
Well, I think people are right. I don't think mainstream politics has worked for the majority of Americans in a very long time. I think the Democrats have been able to garner support through a certain spectrum of issues, and the Republicans as well, while ignoring class issues, economic issues, bread and butter issues for most Americans. So if you think of that, Democrats and Republicans are both neoliberal. They're both parties that support free trade. They both support limiting government interference. They both think that the market is self-correcting. They both support globalization. They're both neoliberal parties. They're both parties of a ruling class plutocratic elite. They're both parties of the banks, the profiteers, the industrial security complex. So that's what those two parties are really all about. And both parties together has presided over a massive transfer of wealth from the bottom 99% of the population, if you will. And of course, this gets even starker if you go lower, like the bottom 50% or the bottom 30% transferred to the top 1% or the top 10%, depending on how you want to look at it. Both parties are unified in that respect. So there's no difference between the two when it comes to class, when it comes to social and economic hierarchy in the United States. So both parties have had to find different issues to distinguish each other from. The Democrats have found identity politics and diversity and tolerance. And all those, I think all of those things are valuable and important. The Republicans have tended to be fearful of those sorts of policies. And instead of promoting identity politics, the Republicans have resisted identity politics, resisted diversity. And they picked up on other issues, social conservatism, moral issues, things like controlling abortion, things like gay marriage, these sorts of hot button moral issues. In both cases, they mask the deeper, more pervasive and far more significant reality of what's happening socially and economically in the United States. And what's happening is real wages have declined since the 1970s. What's happening is the working class, even the middle class, has been completely hollowed out. All those jobs that used to guarantee a decent standard of living for these people are gone. And people are suffering. People are hungry. You know, we have a consumer economy that gives us service jobs, but not the kinds of jobs that give people dignity. So that brings us to Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. What you have there, I think, is two figures within those establishment party who are bringing up an issue that is issues that are taboo for both parties. You know, class issues, bread and butter issues, and challenging the neoliberal status quo in some pretty significant ways. Of course, both had to play also to their party's base. So, you know, and of course, Bernie Sanders is concerned with tolerance and diversity and identity politics, which is a good thing. And of course, those were all parts of his campaign. But he also challenged the Democratic establishment on issues of class and socioeconomics. Donald Trump, by the same token, has to play to the conservative base. He has to bring in Mike Pence. He has to talk about anti-choice. You know, he has to come across as a social conservative. And in some ways, he probably is. He's at least a tremendously unpleasant sort of misogynist. And he's certainly Islamophobic, or at least ignorant about Islam, whatever. But he also talked about globalization. He also talked about neoliberalism. He also talked about the imperial establishment. He also talked about the military-industrial complex. Those issues are taboo, and neither party has really confronted that big elephant in the room in 30, 40 years. So you've got hunger, and it's an understandable hunger among millions of Americans, and I think that people are kind of waking up and beginning to see this. The fact that, you know, the election went to Trump because of this anti-establishment vote, I think is unfortunate. Had the Democrats stuck with Bernie Sanders, I think that he'd be the president-elect right now.
And actually, there's a particular point on that. Now, going back to May 29, 2016, on NBC's Meet the Press, Bernie Sanders was on and was talking about the position he was in at the time as far as the nomination went, and also his popularity versus Trump's. And he said this: right now in every major poll, national poll and statewide poll done in the last month, 6 weeks, we are defeating Trump, often by big numbers and always at a larger margin than Senator Clinton is. So effectively positioning himself as the better choice for the Democratic Party against Trump. And now, lately, since the election, people I've talked to and commentaries I've read in the news have brought this point up about what would have happened if it was Sanders versus Trump. Could he have beaten him? And some people think he could have. What are your thoughts on what may have happened if it was Sanders against Trump?
Well, as a historian, it's always hazardous to to delve into counterfactual history. But I think that Sanders would have won. You know, the primary system was rigged against him. You know, as all Sanders would have had to do was continue to campaign as he had. Sanders was is a smart, dynamic guy, an effective debater. He would have torn Trump to pieces in the debates. Hillary's corruption, the Clinton Foundation, the email scandal. I mean, not that that was all that significant, but all of those things dogged her. And they should have. I mean, she was a candidate with all kinds of baggage. Sanders didn't have that baggage. Also, Sanders wasn't the candidate of the neoliberal establishment. Clinton was. I mean, she epitomizes the neoliberal establishment. Her husband consolidated the neoliberal establishment. The Clintons together did more for, you know, the Republican agenda after Reagan than any Republican ever could have. That's what triangulation and moving to the center was all about. That's what ending welfare as we know it was all about. So Clinton's record is very clear, and where she was going to take the country was very clear. People didn't want it, understandably.
Why were people so surprised that Trump had won? Was it because that the media had only focused on the misogyny and the sexism, like the racism and the xenophobic aspects of Trump, and not... Was it a failing in the media? Was it a failing in the pollsters? Was it a failing in... There's a failure somewhere, but why was it that this became a shock to the world and everywhere else?
Well, I think it was a combination of all those things. I think it was certainly a failure of the media. Mainstream media was a kind of echo chamber for Clinton in a lot of respects. And the focus at the expense of everything else on Trump's misogyny and racism created a climate in which it was difficult to see what his appeal could possibly be to people. Nobody was talking about his critique of neoliberalism. Nobody was talking about his critique of globalist imperialism. And nobody was really talking about this visceral hatred, really, of Hillary Clinton and the things that she represents. If they were talking about that, they were talking about it in a sexist way. They were attributing it to sexism, the fear of a powerful female becoming president. I don't doubt that there was an aspect of that at play in this election. I'm confident that there was. But focusing on that to the exclusion of everything else made it difficult to imagine that any rational person could vote for Donald Trump. And that's what's going on now. People are attributing his election victory basically to this explosion of irrationalism, irrational hatreds and prejudices. I don't buy it. I think that certainly exists, but I don't think it's the main reason. Yeah, I mean, and the other thing has to do with the pollsters. I mean, we have a tendency, especially we in the kind of liberal elite or the chattering classes or in the academy or whatever, to think that the experts have it right. So when the experts tell us that the polls are moving this way or that, we tend to think, oh, yeah, okay, well, that must be how it's happening. This was a repudiation of experts across the board. And I have to admit, perversely, at a kind of delight in this. I'm not delighted that Donald Trump is president, but it's delightful to see all these people who supposedly know better, who have set themselves up as, you know, the best and the brightest, be humiliated in this way.
I want to move to a point you made earlier on, just about essentially the way that the vote carried, that how Trump won and why he may have won this, actually talking shop in a sense and speaking the kind of language that working class people were starving for many years, that seemed to be enough for them to vote for him in numbers. Apparently that may have been what happened in places such as the Rust Belt. I'm wondering about this larger this sentiment that's taking place in the States, this expression of frustration of the status quo not working from their poverty, their unemployment, etc. And about the harnessing of this, about whether this expression that we've seen in the U.S., whether there's a possibility in this moment to move that in a different direction, to offer something different other than the vision that Trump represents, which is a very divisive vision of dividing people up according to particular lines of race, gender, etc. Is there a possibility of taking the moment and taking it elsewhere?
Well, I think there is a possibility. I think, like I said, I mean, just the fact that if we start at the baseline with the presumption that Bernie Sanders would have won this election, we'd be having a very different conversation right now. I think the majority of Americans don't subscribe to the bigotry represented by Donald Trump, but are looking for an alternative, do want something different than what we have now. I have to think, you know, Trump is, in a way, he's the maverick plutocrat. And we've seen others in American history, maverick, anti-establishment, xenophobic plutocrats. I think of Andrew Jackson or Teddy Roosevelt, neither of whom, well, Roosevelt especially, the Republican establishment hated Roosevelt. They thought he was very, very dangerous. He was consigned to the vice presidency because of it. He was so popular that they couldn't keep him off the ticket or out of the party. But they thought if he was vice president, he'd kind of shut up and not do too much damage. Well, McKinley was killed and Roosevelt became president. These people aren't unknown in American history, nor is it impossible that we could take this moment and make something much more productive out of it. But what's desperately needed in the United States, and what would be needed no matter who became president, is a movement on the ground, a movement for change, a movement especially for class change, a movement, you know, a class-based movement for equality and for fairness. And of course, that movement would also respect and celebrate diversity. That movement would also be a feminist movement. That movement would also be a Black Lives Matter movement. That movement would be anti-racist, and that movement would be anti-war. The problem with American electoral politics is it's become so corrupt and also so stage-managed, so mediated by a corporate-owned mainstream media. And Americans in general have become far less aware, it seems to me, of how to be citizens than they would need to be in a thoroughgoing democracy. It's hard to see that movement built. You know, we don't have a nation of citizens. We have a nation of predominantly consumers. And people think, or most people think, that all they have to do is go to the voting booth every 4 years. But the fact is that electoral politics isn't going to do it. And no matter who was elected, whether it was Sanders, Trump, or Clinton, we would need politics on the ground. We would need movement politics to really move the United States in a progressive direction. So that's what we need. And I think that this vote proves that the anger and frustration has built to a level that people are going to respond to a movement. It's just where that movement goes. We've got a lot of people now in the Trump movement. We could focus that anger and frustration in a different way. Some of what Trump is saying makes some sense. I mean, unfortunately, he's so riven with contradiction and bombast that you really don't know what the hell he's going to do or where he's being sincere and where he's not. I think that a lot of people are attracted by what they think that they see in him.
All right, Jeff, do you have any final thoughts to give us?
Yeah, I guess when I was speaking a moment ago, I don't want to give the impression that I think that Americans should create a movement to keep Trump honest or to keep him on his game plan or something like that. I think what's essential right now is that Americans resist Trump and resist what's happening right now. So Trump has had nothing but praise for the police and has been particularly when they handle protesters and Black Lives Matter protests especially. He's promised to crack down on that sort of dissent. Americans need to get out there. They need to fight back. Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock. My great fear now is that the first promise that Trump is going to make good on is going to manifest itself in repression of popular protest movements that are out there right now. So I think we need to really guard against that. I think we need to get out there and we need to support those movements. And we need to build more movements. I mean, a better, more progressive, dare I say, a socialist United States isn't going to happen overnight. It's only going to happen because people organize on the ground, and there's battlegrounds all over the place. And one of those battlegrounds is in the workplace. People need to unionize, and they need to support unions. We're not going to get fairness. We're not going to get a modicum of equality. We're not going to get any kind of redistribution of this obscene amount of wealth held by the 1%. We're not going to get a fair and balanced foreign policy. We're not going to heal the world and prevent climate change if we just tick a ballot every 4 years. We're going to get that through organizing on the ground and building, you know, the shell of or the germ of the new society inside the shell of the old one. It's an old leftist saying. You know, Trump gives us something to fight against. And in a weird way, he's also demonstrated that there really is a hunger for change. And it's change that goes to the core of the status quo. It's not cosmetic change. It's change that attacks the system of corporate consumer capitalism that we're afflicted with right now. And that's what Americans have to organize a movement devoted to.
And that was Professor Jeff Brown, a professor of history, focusing in on American history here at the University of New Brunswick. A bit of a discussion on the U.S. election and a number of questions that the Trump election raises. And that whole interview, this whole show, will be posted on From the Margins Facebook page, From the Margins Fredericton. Just search for that on Facebook and you will find it. The website, I just got a notice from the place where the website is hosted about covering the fees and all that, so I've got to make sure that's done. But anyway, I'm mostly using the Facebook page now, so go check that out. And the whole show will be up there, I'd say probably in the next few hours. So you can look for it this evening if you only caught a piece of it and want to hear the rest. So yeah, From the Margins, Fredericton, just search for it on Facebook and you'll find it. It'll be up there sometime later today. Okay, and that does it for the show for the most part. We got some time left and we're going to go to some music. Here's a great song about elections and electioneering. This is Radiohead. All right, well, just about done here on From the Margins for this week. I'm going to go out on this song by The Coup, Ride the Fence. Just a bit of a warning. There's some strong language in this song for those who care about that.
A sentence that you can't pronounce. I'm also anti-narco, anti-vice. 911 wants the anti-Christ. They anti-social for an M60. Cause I'm anti the anti-nigga machine. Proletarian, funkadelic, parliamentarian, pro-revolt, in the 21st century. Pro running up in chambers saying fuck it all. But bring the people with you, that's the protocol. It's pretty dreadful like jailbreaks. The whole world is anti-United Snakes. So check it out, anticipate the Shannon Venom. And move your antibody to this revolution rhythm. We gon' be fucking with them pro-union, but most lost they bite. Anti-motherfuckers crossing a strike. Take a look around and be fucked.